Well, hello and welcome to the first of a new series of podcasts brought to you by Society Guardian in association with knowhownonprofit.org. I'm David Brindle, I'm the Guardian's Public Services Editor, and over the next few months we'll be looking into the issues facing the charity and voluntary sectors as we tackle challenging times economically as well as face uncertain times politically. We'll be hearing from leading figures in the not-for-profit sector, as well as some lesser-known organisations with intriguing stories to tell. But most of all, we want to hear from you. Your emails, texts and tweets will dictate what we cover and who we talk to. So, if there's a burning issue you want us to cover, or you want to have a say on a particular topic, we'd like to invite you to join in the conversation. You can send us a message at charityeffectiveness@guardian.co.uk. And you'll be able to see comments and more at guardian.co.uk/charity-effectiveness. In this first podcast, I'm joined by Stuart Etherington, Chief Executive of NCVO, Dame Mary Marsh, the former Chief Exec of NSPCC, and now Director of the CLAW Social Leadership Programme, Paul Palmer, Professor of Voluntary Sector Management at the CAS Centre for Charity Effectiveness, which is responsible for knowhownonprofit.org, and Nirjay Mahindru, Chief Executive of the Interact Reading Service, a charity that supports stroke patients and which won a Guardian Charity Award in 2009. Welcome, all of you.
Hi, David.
Thanks, Hello. David.
Pleased to be here.
Before we get started, we need to clear something up. Who's this podcast for? Is it the charity sector? Or are we talking about the voluntary sector, the social enterprise sector? The third sector. We posted this question on Twitter and Facebook and already had some interesting responses, including, for example, impact organisations and the social action sector. And we've been speaking to a few people working in the sector, however we're going to describe it, and this is what they say.
I think the best definition for the sector we work in, we would tend to look at it as the social action sector.
I'd call it charity sector.
Gosh, we call it everything. Civil society, NGOs, third sector.
I'd call it the giving something back sector.
Stuart, you favour the civil society definition, don't you?
Yes, I think this sums up, I think, the breadth of the sector quite well. It's got long historical antecedents, first mentioned in the 18th century. It sees the sector as an important and independent bastion of liberty. It's not just a definition of a sector defined by government. And I think one of the problems with the third sector, apart from the fact that nobody trains for bronze, is that third sector is almost foisted upon us. Civil society has a much more historical basis, and it's this breadth of independent citizens coming together for the public good that I find the most attractive description.
Mary, can you go with that?
I'm not sure. I understand what Stuart's argument about this, and, you know, all credit to him. He started using this with NCVO long before anyone else did. And I can see the importance, particularly of the emphasis of something that implies the independence. I quite like the point made earlier by the contributor talking about social action, because I do think it is an active sector that is intervening for the social good. So I prefer myself, particularly sitting where I am now with a leadership programme for organisations with a social purpose, to talk about the social sector. But actually, I think the word sector possibly is the bit that's getting us into a trap, because it kind of suggests we're separate from everybody else. But actually what we're about is the dynamic bit of interaction that brings everybody together. Because we can't exist or work or deliver without complete active contribution and direct engagement from everybody in the community, in the private sector and the public sector.
Paul, your centre is called Charity Effectiveness. Would you prefer to stick with something traditional like that?
Well, I think the point is that if you
taking back to first sector first, the interesting thing about the term third sector is that politicians and they have flavours. And it was actually a previous Labour government back in 1979, that used a wonderful expression, non-statutory sector, and for a number of years, and indeed NCVO's publications in the late 1970s referred to the role of the non-statutory sector. So Stuart's always been ahead, or NCVO's always been ahead of the time in picking up changes, because they then changed their mind and started referring back to the voluntary sector back in the 80s. Taking your point about history, the interesting thing about charity, of course, is it has been the longest used term, and it's a recognisable term, particularly in both the UK but also around the world. So there's an interesting debate about why it's been a term that's often been abused and misunderstood as well. But it's a contrasting landscape, and I suspect that civil society, as Stuart quite rightly has picked up on, will be in for a time, and then something else will emerge probably in about 10 years' time to replace that.
Nirjay, civil society, social sector, or plain old charity?
It's plain old charity for me, because I think that that is the phrase that most ordinary people understand. I think that the problem with civil society, etc., is that it then needs extra explanation. Ordinary people just understand what a straightforward charity is, and so it's the charity sector for me.
Well, I'm sure this is something that's going to run and run. If you've got a suggestion, drop us an email at charityeffectiveness@guardian.co.uk. And a bit later on, we'll be hearing from a brand expert who we've asked to come up with some ideas as well.
I'm someone who's been presented over many years with many branding challenges. Branding this sector is one of the toughest challenges that I would have ever been delivered.
More from him later on. So, we're here to discuss the challenges facing the sector, however we're going to describe it, or indeed if we're going to call it a sector at all. But before I ask the panel here in the studio, we've been talking to a group of people from a range of organisations about the challenges they're facing.
My name's Penny G. I work for Volunteering England, and I'm also a volunteer. I think the biggest challenges facing my organisation and others in the sector, probably the same thing comes up again and again, is funding. People are wondering where the next pot of money is coming from, especially with a new government coming in May. So I guess that is the biggest challenge for everybody.
My name's Mel Andrews, and I'm a campaign manager at the RSPCA for farm animal campaigns. Big challenges that we're facing at the moment is communicating to people in a time of recession where money's tight and we're trying to communicate about higher welfare.
I'm Mark Brown. I'm the Development Director of Social Spider CIC, which is a small not-for-profit company that does community media projects. I think the challenges that we face mostly are ones of cash flow, because it's very difficult to convince any funder that it's worth taking a chance on an innovative project.
My name is Stephen Buckley. I'm the Head of Communications and Brand for Christian Aid, the international NGO. One of the challenges that we're seeing is around accountability and transparency. No longer are we able to simply to give an Excel spreadsheet with some metrics in. We're now expected to provide a narrative for donors that says, here's the impact we've made for individuals, for communities. Now, that's a challenge for a communications professional, because we've got an awful lot of programmes in an awful lot of countries around the world, and how we tell those stories in a meaningful way is going to be increasingly important in the year ahead.
Nidja, you're working on the front line with a smaller charity. Do you recognise those concerns about funding?
Very much so. And I think in the area of funding, the problematic position for a charity like Interact Reading Service is this fixation that trusts and foundations have always had on new projects. So the idea that we will give funding for a new project rather than looking at core funding. And I think that within the notion of we're all going to struggle with funding possibly in the next couple of years, it's how that funding is particularly focused. And I think that the last comment that we heard was particularly interesting. It's very, very difficult for some charities like ours to proffer clinical evidence on the efficacy of our work. That has always been a difficult thing. And a hell of a lot of trusts and foundations now want you to go into a plethora of explanations for the validity and the efficacy of your work. Added to that, we seem to have, you know, red tapeism gone mad, particularly for smaller charities. And the classic example I would give is the rise of CRB clearances. Now, of course, one understands why these things happen, but the red tapeism that Interact Reading Service has gone through in the last couple of years has been quite dramatic for a very, very small charity.
Paul Palmer, is red tapeism, as Nirjay puts it, getting in the way of charities generally?
I think there's, from an operational point of view, I think the issues that have been raised, particularly around CRB checks and others, I mean, it was expressed to me the other day by one charity that actually they worked out that their staff spent 1 month of 12, if you worked it out in day terms, doing nothing else but health and safety training. So a 12th of that, you know, basically, I think we've probably gone a bit too far. To pick up on the major points that you mentioned about funding and the challenges ahead, I think the first thing I would say is, and I'm going to be quite reasonably controversial here, Stuart a few years ago made the comment that we were in a golden age in the voluntary sector, and I think he was totally right. I now like to allude it more to a sweet shop, and the sweet shop being starting to close down and instead turning into a nasty medicine shop, perhaps picking up on the Good and Bad Society earlier comments. The point about the sweet shop will be that effectively it's going to be a tougher and meaner time. And I'm sure you're going to start talking about micromanagement issues in a minute. But the issues are going to be around, for example, we've seen a sector that has primarily enjoyed unprecedented funding in relation from the state that will now come to an end. The NCVO statistics very reliably show this massive surge of government funding over the years. And so picking up, we're going to have to look at going back maybe to traditional sources, going back to the definition of charity, for example, and looking at, for example, philanthropy and perhaps the private sector. It's worth remembering that the philanthropy side of the UK charity economy is actually still the largest point, despite all this focus on government. The UK is the second largest wealth giver in the world, the UK population. Some 54% of the UK population regularly give. And most interestingly, there's about just over 300,000 millionaires in the United Kingdom who give away just over 5% of their wealth each year. Now, if they can be encouraged to get to the US level, which is about 8% for that similar group, then that starts to, these are figures I produced earlier in a report, that starts to raise money towards about twice the size of the UK current voluntary sector's income. So there is opportunities. Equally, I think when we talk about government, and again, the famous comment you always learn from the lessons of history, the interesting thing is if a government did come in with major cutbacks, it's worth remembering that when we were in this economic situation last time, which was the late 70s, early 80s, we had the Manpower Services Commission, which was probably the biggest funder ever of the voluntary sector, pre-going anything else. And one would suspect that the voluntary sector is not going to be all bad news. There's going to be opportunity.
Yeah. Mary, new sources of funding seems to be the great hope. Is that something you'd go along with?
Well, certainly funding is up right now and for the years we can see ahead, I think, going to be the big challenge. And sources of funding, I think, as Paul was alluding just then, I think the likelihood is that there will certainly continue to be statutory sources of funding, but they won't come in the same sort of pots as we've perhaps had access to previously. And I think back to Nirjay's earlier point about this obsession with what the government also gets into, what they call additionality, where you can't fund things because you've already been doing them. They can only fund expansion or a completely new initiative. And this is utter madness, really. And there's some strange things about the approach to funding, this group of organisations, charities, social sector, whatever we want to call it, where our funding is kind of taken apart in pieces. When a private sector organisation comes along to deliver a service, they price it and they present the contract and the price is accepted or it isn't. Nobody goes away and digs into their overheads or anything else. And you can be sure they'll include in their pricing some investment in their overhead leadership development, their capacity, their evaluation, the things that fit into this mad thing that we've got into the way of calling core costs. Every organisation has core costs. We're not peculiar in that. It's just we choose to separate them off and so do our funders. So I think there is a big challenge in maximising, and the new philanthropy, I think, could grow if we manage it right. But the impact measurement's tricky because you don't get impact in a year, but that's often what we're being asked to demonstrate. If you invest in social change, this is a long process, and it's how do you demonstrate impact over a period of time, and how do you get confidence in an organisation it's going to deliver, even if you're not going to see it straight away? That's the case we're going to have to be able to make confidently with good evidence of our track record previously.
Stuart, how can we balance the short-term pressures with the necessary long game in terms of being able to prove impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think the funding question relates to that very importantly. I mean, the story of what's happened to the sector in the last 10 years is a very simple one. Philanthropy's just about kept pace with or grown slightly more than inflation. The principal driver of growth has been government money, and that government money has come in the form of contracts for service delivery. That is the simple description of what has happened to the sector. What we've seen now in relation to the recession is a potential double influence. Firstly, we've seen philanthropy fall. Most of the data that we produce with the Charities Aid Foundation have showed about 11% drop in philanthropy. That's before any significant cuts in public spending, which people are expecting in 2011. What that will mean, I think, is quite short-term decisions being made fairly quickly, and that will have downward pressure on price and therefore will drive voluntary organisations into being much more price sensitive. There'll be, I think, increasing competition between the private sector and the voluntary sector for contracts for service, and that will become quite vicious, I think. One of the more interesting potential developments is what is being said about new mutualism in relation to public services, and I think that that may have a more significant impact. So what I think, there's no iron law that says the sector must grow year on year every year, and it may well be that we may see a contraction or at least a reconfiguration of the sector in the next few years. I think it's going to be tough times. Where I think there is potential for development is both in terms of new mutualism, which I've talked about, but also in terms of very localised developments. There's quite a thrust now towards the local, and I think we will see voluntary organisations thinking about not just going for the government buck, but other ways in which they might assist citizens and develop services with the citizens. You can see possibly a growth in volunteering and a growth in community engagement, and I think that that may well be a feature going forward. But in terms of big tranches of government money, I don't see that necessarily being a big engine for growth in the future.
Do you think this is going to have implications for image and public perception of the sector, Mary, that as organisations struggle for new sources of funding, are they going to have to address that challenge?
I think public trust and confidence is one of our most precious assets, and we don't pay attention to it, you know, at our peril, I think. And I think there are dangers in this increasing scrutiny of charities, of the public getting hold of perspectives about how money is invested, how it's spent, what results come as a consequence, that could be quite damaging. And, of course, you've only got to have one or two really difficult stories of people quite clearly not spending money effectively and you know, excessive waste or a failed project, and that could be difficult. Actually, if we're going to stay being the centre for innovation, change, risk, trying new things, we ought to be doing things that fail. What matters is that we learn from them and apply that learning back into what we do. And I think to run into this risky territory where I think that kind of experimentation and Stuart was saying in terms of what communities do, trying completely new models of delivery, that's going to be risky. And keeping public trust and confidence alongside that will be challenging, because we must sustain that voluntary giving, which in the UK there's such a long tradition of. Yes, we can, you know, we've all want to keep holding on to what we've got and growing it. But if we don't keep that confidence of voluntary giving, then we really are in serious difficulties.
Nijay, does this feel like a good time to be risk-taking, or is the inclination more to hunker down and wait till the storm has passed?
The inclination is to hunker down and wait till the storm has passed, although I think that the problem of leaders of small charities is that, certainly I feel that I have my one hand tied behind my back. And it's for various reasons. A classic example is simple application forms for funding, whether it comes from the National Lottery or whether it comes from a trust or a foundation. These days, they are so complicated, it needs a professional accountant to fill them in rather than a chief executive looking at things from a strategic point of view. And so in that sense, there's also the issue of, because of the nature of funding, I can't sit around and think, right, this is what I'd like to do in 5 years' time for Interact Reading Service. Because we're forever, as Mary said earlier, we're forever looking over our shoulders, thinking, well, where is the next batch of money going to come from for the next 12 months, let alone the next 5 years? And so in that sense, it's very difficult for us to think strategically. I mean, there is also an issue where due diligence has put a hell of a lot of small charities into a little bit of a pickle. The example would be, we were always told it's always very good for a charity to build up a body of reserves. So when you come to a rainy day or an economic climate that we have now, you could use your reserves. The problem is that once you build up a body of reserves and then you start applying for various funding pots and opportunities, so many trusts, foundations and governments look at your application and go, oh, well, they've got a whole load of reserves anyway. There's no point funding them. So you're then in a difficult catch-22. You think, well, actually, we were doing best practice and due diligence, and we're now being penalised for it.
Stuart, does that resonate with what you hear from your member organisations across the country?
Yes, I mean, I think there's genuine concern that the complexities in chasing an increasingly diminishing pound. One of the possible solutions to that is to strengthen the organisations that can provide support for smaller organisations. So it seems to me that taking on board a lot of the accounting, a lot of the due diligence functions in a sort of back office way, supporting frontline organisations to do what they do best, which is to interact with users, to provide services, which can be very innovative. That seems to me to be a possible way forward. We need to find ways of operating more collectively, particularly at a local level, I think, where people can go have a place which provides these services for them. But going back just briefly to the point about innovation, I think we have to take more risk in this particular environment. The reason is simply this. If you're seeing significant reductions in public spending, and increasing demand for the services that we provide, whether that be because of demography or just because citizens are more active, the only way out of that particular problem is to innovate more, to redesign, to come up with new ideas about how services can be provided. And that has been a role that the sector has performed for centuries, and it will perform it again. It's just that type of sector.
Okay, these are themes I'm sure we'll be returning to in future broadcasts, and so thanks for that discussion for now. Stay with me, but for now, thank you very much. As part of this series of podcasts, we're running polls on a number of issues affecting people working in the sector, from money and staffing to funding and public service contracts. We're looking for your views on a whole range of topics. The results of these polls will help shape the future podcast, so please do take part. You can find the polls at the following web address, guardian.co.uk/charity-effectiveness. And if there's an issue you'd like us to cover, whether it's skills and training, or fundraising, or the contract culture, or whatever it might be, please do email us at charityeffectiveness@guardian.co.uk. Earlier, we were discussing what to call this constantly growing sector, Stuart is sitting firm on civil society. He seems fixed on that. But to give us a different perspective, we've asked a brand expert for his view. Marcel Noble is the founder of the brand agency Creative and Commercial, and he's worked with hundreds of different brands, including well-known names like Adidas, Coca-Cola, Heinz, M&S, Microsoft and Topshop. Could he be the man for us?
I'm someone who's been presented over many years with many branding challenges. Branding this sector is one of the toughest challenges that I would have ever been delivered. Epictetus, the Greek philosopher, said, first know who you are, then adorn yourself accordingly. I ask the question, does this sector really know who it is and what it is? We talk about
the charity sector,
the social enterprise sector,
the volunteer sector,
the third sector,
the civil society sector.
Is this all the same sector? Is it 5, 6, 7 sectors? It's very confusing indeed. One of the key challenges, I would say, is that a name should be agreed upon and consistently used. Choose a name that actually has some meaning, i.e. that is not a collection of initials. As a starting point, one has to, like with any brand, actually try and define the key components of the sector. What is it that actually defines the sector? What is the DNA of this sector? In defining what this sector is, we want to make it wide enough to embrace those entities that we feel should fall within it, but also narrow enough to make it something that's meaningful. Just like Volvo has been all about safety, Avis trying harder, Heineken about refreshment. What is the DNA that actually runs through this sector? There are so many other brands out there that you really do need to be different, distinctive and stand out. Have some creativity and freshness about you. It's no use being wallpaper. And be enduring. If you're going to say you're something, then stand by your guns. Just stick with that. This is such a crucial sector and tough because you have such a spectrum of organisations within it that to actually arrive at something which is meaningful, which is salient, and which is appropriate, and will actually be relevant to all these organisations, will be very, very tough indeed.
Some brief thoughts. Is Marcel being hopelessly utopian? Can we identify this DNA, Mary?
Well, I think that you need to go back to my own thinking on this of whether we are a sector at all or whether we are part of, you know, a significant and a key part of society. But because we are a dynamic part of society, we are interacting with lots of other parts of it. So to try and give us a singular definition that gives us a unique place is probably, as he was quite rightly saying, is a pretty huge challenge. But I do recognise that you want something that the public understands. And that's why charity, I think I agree, is one that's known, even yes. if people don't fully understand it.
Yes, I agree with that, with what Mary has just said at the end there, that for me, whenever I'm in the office, one of the things that I always say to the people who work at Interact is, please keep it simple. Whatever you do, whatever we're sending out to the world, whatever message it is, keep it simple. And I just think that charity sector is something that ordinary people understand. It's simple, it's straightforward.
Good. Well, let us hear your views. But that brings us to the end of this first podcast. Thanks to the panel, Stuart Etherington, Dame Mary Marsh, Paul Palmer and Nirjay Mahindru. And I'm David Brindle. Remember, do get in touch. We want to hear from you about anything you've heard in this podcast or any issues you'd like us to cover in the future. That email address again, charityeffectiveness@guardian.co.uk. Thanks for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by Society Guardian in association with knowhownonprofit.org and produced by Sound Delivery.